All right, welcome everyone. Nice to see everyone, both here in person and also online. So I want to talk about this last image here in this series, the ox herding, entering the marketplace with open arms, open hands. Next month, we'll look at the whole set of 10 together, and Carrie will be leading tomorrow, next Monday, because I'll be on retreat, or teaching retreat. So this image here, I'll blank myself out for a second. So you can see online and on person, there's just this image of this Buddha-like person coming into the village. Entering the marketplace with open hands. Now this image addresses this fundamental question that we have in our practice. How do we live our lives once we're fully awakened? What does our lives look like? How does that show up in my jobs, in my relationships with my children, with my parents? How can we have those and still be fully awakened? And if so, what does that look like? Now, another form of this question actually happens really early on in our practice and throughout our practice from a little different expression. And we notice how introspective the practice is, how internal it is, and how, in some ways very passive, very receptive. We're just meeting the moment how it is without adding anything to it, practicing releasing our resistance to it. Just observing without judgment. Okay, that's kind of a fundamental way of our meditation practice. And we ask ourselves, rightfully so, early on and throughout our practice, what, if anything, does this have to do with my life? You know, this kind of receptive thing, my life is anything but passive, anything but receptive. I'm having constantly juggle all these demands, all these things going on in my internal life, in my world, in my relationships. How does the practice work with jobs, relationships, and children? So these are really the same, in some ways, the same question. We get a taste of this in our practice, how, wow, this is a very still practice, very receptive. And how do I carry that into the chaos of my life? And then we project that forward into awakening. How does that even show up as a person with jobs, with responsibilities, with interests, with hobbies? So I want to explore both of these, this question together tonight with you. One way to frame Dharma practice is realizing that form is emptiness and emptiness is form. Right. So this is from the famous line from the Heart Sutta from the Zen tradition. And here's a short section of this. Form is no other than emptiness. Emptiness is no other than form. Form is only emptiness. Emptiness only form. Feeling, thought, and choice, consciousness itself are the same as this. Okay, so this, we're going to unpack this because it seems a little, what are they talking about? It seems really crazy. This form is no other than emptiness. Emptiness is no other than form, this strange riddle. And yet this answer to this question of how does our lives from an awakened place show up? How do we actually live from that awakened place? Or how do we live our lives from that changing relationship to life? How does that show up is really fundamental to this phrase or this short line. So this fundamental question of how do we live from an awakened heart and mind or from our growing internal stillness? How does emptiness express itself as form in all the different myriad things of our lives? So let's unpack this a little bit. So first of all, emptiness. Sometimes we get a little hung up on that word because emptiness brings to mind the sense of a void, of lack, of absence of anything. And actually what it's pointing toward is not something that's empty in that normal way we think of it, but actually very full, very alive. But emptiness as a word does capture something. And what it's empty of is it's lacking this isolated, separate sense of self. we see the nature of this profound interconnection. The famous sage, Indian sage, Nirsagadatta, when I look inside and see that I am nothing, that is wisdom. When I look outside and see that I am everything, that is love. And between these two, my life flows. When I look inside and see that I am nothing, that is wisdom. When I look outside and see that I am everything, that is love. And between these two, my life flows. So emptiness, that internal sense of emptiness, and yet looking outward, seeing the interconnection, the lack of separation. So empty of what? Empty of that I, me, and mine. This picture is expressing a very deep and full awakening and how that matures. But we start to practice that from day one. There's very basic instructions of starting the process of releasing, disengaging from that sense of self. Now we're meditating, we feel that sense of stability of attention. It's not really wandering around too much. And we're also noticing that we're meeting the moment without a lot of resistance. We're not fighting it, not trying to change it, not even trying to label it, just sensing it moment by moment, as I was trying to guide us in that instructions at the beginning of this evening. We become much less established than normal. We are a little bit more empty. And yet there's still a presence. There's still something that's connected. Right? So it's this paradox, that normal sense of meanness, of I-ness, is not so strong when we're meditating in that. It's when it's really cooking, when there's that steadiness, when there's that relationship to moment's experience, but just simply abiding with, simply connecting with. So there's great depths of this, but a taste is still significant. And I want us to really remember that these small tastes we sometimes gloss over is just this kind of condition that meditation induced in us. But reframe it not so much as a taste or just a momentary arising of something, but actually a glimpse into something that's actually profoundly true. Profoundly true. This all allows us to start to reorient our practice to that thinning of self. This is a line that Rodney Smith used a few years ago in a non-residential, this thinning of self, this process of reorienting our practice toward liberation. So this question of how does emptiness express as form, whether full awakening or this thinning of self? So back to the Heart Sutta, form is no other than emptiness. Emptiness is no other than form. Form is only emptiness. Emptiness is only form. Feeling, thought, and choice, consciousness itself, are the same as this. Right. So this is a critical piece that we'll keep exploring tonight. So to help understand this, to kind of look at this riddle that this image is showing us, of how do we really manifest our practice in the midst of our lives. Looking at this process of Dharma practice that these pictures have been portraying for these last 10 months together, it's kind of like, I'm going to reframe it as around this form and formless. So first of all, we start off practice with form is everything. Okay, form is the structure of life, the details of life. It's really a shorthand for the five aggregates. Okay, in this Heart Sutta, the Buddha goes on to talk about form is only emptiness, emptiness only form, but feeling, thought, and choice, consciousness itself, are also the same as this. This is the five aggregates. So not to get too bogged down in those pieces there, but it's basically one way of looking at how, as human beings, we create this sense of me. We see something, we hear something, sense something. That's the forms of life. We kind of solidify it, right? We have a reaction to it. We like it or dislike it. It's pleasant or unpleasant, the feeling tone. We fix it in our memory. Well, I've heard that sound before. That's a bus with a squealing brake. Okay, so that's perception, places in our history. Then we start to think about it. We start to do something with it. That's the choice, the volitional impulses. And consciousness is kind of the whole thing that takes shape to hold that hearing. There's a new consciousness for sight, new consciousness for seeing. So all these things, we clump together and say, okay, that's I, that's me. What Buddha called the five clinging aggregates, that creates this isolated sense of self, creating it from something that's inherently empty. So back to these four stages. So again, form, really, really use all those five aggregates, all this process of self. So form is everything. That's how we start practice. Okay, that's everything. That's all we know. Then we start to practice, and like we've been noticing, like in the meditation or that softening, that thinning, we start to realize that that form that we thought was so solid is actually empty. You start to see kind of holes through that. You can see this very immediately, like you're sitting and just the outline of your body, the idea of body, the visual impulse of body. When you close your eyes and go into the felt sense of it, that idea starts to fall away. That's form starting to be released. Okay, so this is the next stage. Form, we realize, is empty. Then we start to get a little fixated. We say, emptiness is everything. Okay, that's the thing. That's what I want. Emptiness is the only thing that matters. And then finally, there's a maturation represented in this picture. We realize emptiness is form. We actually realize that form is emptiness. So this is the teaching of the ox herding pictures. So let's try to make this more concrete. I know this is a little out there, a little abstract perhaps. So this first stage, form is everything. You know, this is all going back to that central question of how do we show up fully in our practice, in our lives, from the depth of our practice. So let's do an example. Form is everything. So right now we're sitting here and we can hear the traffic go by. Maybe you can hear a particular bus, whatever sound you might be hearing in your place that you're listening from. You can also do this visually. You might look at something like the bell, look at the Defender AV system. You might look at a chair. So we perceive it. That's the first perception. And in that very perception, we know what it is, right? We have this idea what it is. We know what it's used for. We have, you know, it fixes in our memory of all those other times we've encountered that sound, that experience, that sight. So try to do this as I'm talking you through. Now, as soon as we do that, as soon as we say, okay, that's a chair, we've actually created form. We've actualized it. We've created it in relationship to ourselves. So more accurately said, we've created ourselves, sense of self in relationship to it. Right? So we've created, okay, I'm seeing the chair. It's easier to see it really externally. Okay, there's a chair. I know what a chair is. It's easier to free it up from that perspective. But learning to free up that definition, then we actually free up ourselves. So we start to see something like a chair or hear a sound. We create the form. It becomes more solid in our consciousness. Then we can start to interact with it. We start to do stuff with it. We start to have feeling tones around it. Is it pleasant? Is it unpleasant? Is it neutral? Springboard for disliking, for liking, for craving, for clinging. We start to think about it. Okay, I want to do something around it. I want to maybe reupholster it. I want to, you know, get a noise counseling earphones. That's the volitional impulses. We start to work around it. We start to chew around it, think about it. Our actions naturally flow from that. And all that process, you know, it happens in a microsecond. But this is a very simple, benign example. We'll go into something a little bit more charged in a second. But with that identification of that thing, making that form, we're also creating the locus of who we are, where we are. The person who is hearing, the person who's remembering, who's thinking, who's feeling, who's liking, disliking. That's the echolocation I talked about a while back. We see something and it echoes back and forms that sense of me. So a poetic way of saying this from Samuel Green, a short line is, everything carries the burden of what we know until we let it be itself again. So let that sink in for a second. Every time we see something, hear something, perceive something, it automatically tends to carry the burden of what we know about it, our opinions, our history. This is the weight of perception, of nama-rupa, from the dependent origination. Right? So that weight has a burden, has a way of imprisoning that object. Dharma practice is simply about freeing up that prison, freeing it up, releasing it. So this is, it may seem a little abstract, but this is really the core of our suffering. This is the core of this question of how do we live our awakened heart. So let's take it a little bit more of a, not such a benign example. I like to give benign examples because they're easier to work with. You know, like that water bottle there is not going to, yell at me or do anything with me. It can just sit there. I can just ignore it and nothing's going to happen. Or I can play with it. Notice the perception of seeing, oh, there's a water bottle, liking, disliking, memory. And as I do that, as I identify those pieces, there's also potential for going underneath those, to freeing it up from that. That's the purpose of practice. That's why the meditation instructions are so darn simple. Just meet the moment just how it is. Seems so elemental. And yet, if we follow that through, it does something very profound to me who's as a meditator. Okay, so let's give another example. This is, again, form is everything. This is our normal state of suffering, normal state of dukkha. So imagine the last time someone related to you through their perception. Okay, so the perception of things like the race that they perceived you as, the gender they perceived you as, sexual orientation, your age, your ability, your skill, your class, your religious affiliation, whatever it might be that they were relating to you from that stereotype, if you will, that projection was like just loading that burden. Okay, you're that kind of a person. That's how I'm going to relate to you as. I think we can all relate to that. Some much more on a daily basis. Sometimes others we have to find places for that. I'm sorry, I got distracted by something going on the screen there. So when that happens to you, you can feel how imprisoning that is, that the person's not seeing you for who you are, they're seeing you through that lens. And you have to kind of fight to break through that. And, it doesn't feel good. It's very painful. It can be very, very harmful. And we do the exact same thing to other people. We do that exact same thing to other people. And start to notice that when you see another person and the first thing that comes to mind, oh, that's a person of this gender, this race, whatever it might be, this orientation, and how you suddenly have this thing that loads up. That's the real life expression of these aggregates showing up. It's the nama-rupa, the name and form, or from the aggregates, the perception. And we relate to it from our idea. We relate to it from our projection, our history, instead of the actual thing. So I do this just to get a sense of the suffering that's caused by form is everything. Form is all there is. Okay? So this is relating to how this essential question, this whole question of this talk, how does emptiness manifest as form? First, we see how form manifests as form. Okay, so now the next stage. We start to practice. We start to see through this. We start to realize this form that we took as so solid is empty. We start to move into emptiness. Okay, this stage is actually very it can be very exciting. It can also be a little disconcerting. It's exciting because we start to see, well, I'm seeing life in a very different way. I start to realize that the very way I've been perceiving life is what's created the suffering. And there's a potential for releasing that. It's a little disconcerting because you realize you've spent your whole life doing that, and you're not quite sure how are you going to be in the world if you're not always creating that form. So we, in some ways, we become a little less functional at this stage. We're not quite sure how I'm supposed to do life because the insight is opening, but it hasn't matured as much yet. So this is a very, this emptiness, seeing emptiness in form is very transformational. It really changes. It's a game changer, as they like to say. Things we took as being solid and changing, we see how they're arising and passing away. We see this a lot in our opinions, in our thoughts, in our ideas, the manifestations of me, of mine. And as we see that, there's this, see, external form is empty. We also see this internal emptiness. And we start to see that things that used to drive us, you know, like our need for approval, for what do you call it, acclaim, or maybe our, some of our, you know, self-inadequacy, all those things that start to drive us, motivate us, seem to be missing. They're not in there in the same way. There's not that same engine, that same fuel pushing us. They start to lose some of their power. They become a little more inert. So at times we can feel a little bit like a sailboat that's becalmed. There's no wind. There's no energy to move. We're not sure, okay, this energy that I've used my whole life to push those sails has fallen away by seeing through form, seeing into emptiness. So what's going to blow those sails? You know, this is that core question. We start to realize, okay, what's going to make my life go if I'm not trying to reinforce my ego, trying to reinforce myself? There's now that reinforcing of that echolocation. So this is a little bit of a disconcerting time. And then the next stage is interesting, when emptiness is everything. So the self is like, in this last stage, form is empty. The sense of me becomes less established. We see something we thought was so solid is not so solid. And then our ego comes in, our minds, or a sense of self says, okay, I got to reorient. I need to find a new place. And that's going to be the place that emptiness is everything. That's the new flag. That's the new rallying point. And this is this subtle sense of me, of self, that's claimed a position that, okay, emptiness is everything. Form, I'm just going to disregard all of that. Okay, this is a stage. It's also not very functional in the world. And finally, we go to the last stage. Okay, this is emptiness is form. And also the mirror image of that form is emptiness. This is the whole question around this talk or this exploration of this picture. You know, how does something that's inherently empty show up in the world? How does it show up and have expression? How does it do things? How does that sailboat start to move? So going back to that example of hearing a sound like a bird or a bus going by or seeing some object. Okay, so picking another object and seeing how you can see the form of it, the ideas around it, but you can choose not to kind of double down on that idea. And just let this, the idea kind of float, almost let it suspend. So you go into the direct experience of that object, that thing, that sound, that sight. Now, if you do that, and you really relax into it, and you feel a little bit of a like flutter in your stomach, like, whoa, I don't know who, what I am if I'm not relating to something through my ideas. That's a good sign, actually. that means you're on the right track. It means you're on the right track, right? So you're allowing yourself to become less defined in relationship, right? There's still, I can see this bell, for example, but if I let go of what it does and the sound that it produces and all the history on all the bells I've heard, I'm just perceiving it. There's a way that it becomes more vivid, more alive, because our label, our idea kind of deadens it. Like, okay, I see it. I don't have to pay attention to it so much. It actually brings it back into intimacy, into connection. So then I strike it, the impulse to striking it, coming from wherever that might be, not from that sense of I'm going to have to make it sound really good, I have to make it sound just right. But if it's just the stillness, and you hear the sound, there's a certain wonder that comes up from that. Right? So this is part of that question of how does form, what's formless, show up in form. Right? So this, you do this with people. You see a person that you've known for many years or just met, whatever, it doesn't matter. Notice how you put the form on them. You want to form them. You want to place them in a certain way. See if you can see through that. Just let that be soft. And you open to the actual way they are in this moment. Everything carries the burden of what we know until we let it be itself again. And in doing this, we start to become less bound by our impulses, by our perception. There's a way we start to relate to life in a very spontaneous way. There's this freedom to meeting life, just how it's arising. There's this way that becomes free of that prison that we placed on it. So there's meeting and releasing. And there's a delight in the form. There's delight in the diversity of life. There's discernment. There's this wisdom to know, okay, this is perhaps going to cause harm if I go into that way, if I don't have a certain wisdom of how to choose, how to act around it. So notice this in the small ways and subtle ways in your life. And if you're meditating at all, it's happening in some degree. We just tend not to notice it because it's not where we're focused on. We're focused on form as everything. Notice how form starts to release itself. Again, form is a shorthand for all these aggregates, which is a shorthand for all this mixture of self, selfing. You start to release that. Notice how it just starts to fall away, just in small ways. You might just be sitting waiting for the bus and just meeting this moment. Someone says hello and you turn to them and you say hello from a very different place. Start to bring that to your attention, to your forefront. Noticing how things that used to trigger you just somehow don't anyway, anymore. Something is missing from that whole process. And the ways that you're held in that prison start to fall away. This is going into the marketplace. This is coming in how emptiness breathes life into form. Concluding with this poem that speaks to this. One morning we'll wake up and we will and forget to build that wall we've been building. The one between us. The one we've been building for years, perhaps, out of some sense of right and boundary. Perhaps out of habit. One morning we will wake up and let our empty hands hang empty at our sides. Perhaps they will rise, as empty things sometimes do when blown by the wind. Perhaps they will simply will not remember how to grasp, how to rage. We will wake up that morning and we will have misplaced all our theories about why and how and who did what to whom. We will have mislaid all our timelines of when and plans of what, and we will not scramble to write the plans and theories anew. On that morning, not much else will have changed. Whatever is blooming will still be in bloom. Whatever is wilting will wilt. There will be fields to plow and trains to load and children to feed and work to do. And in every moment, in every action, we will feel the urge to say thank you. We will follow the urge to bow. One Morning by Rosemary Wetutola Traumler. That's a practice poem. That's instructions for our whole life. All right. Thank you for your attention. All right. I realize this talk is a little subtle, a little out there. So I'd like to give you a chance to help me clarify anything. Like, what were you talking about? Bring up those questions and we can try to unpack that. So we'll give you some space. If there's any questions in the room, online, you can raise your virtual hand or physical hand. All right, Iris.
Hi there. Thank you. I feel like I have a sense of what emptiness is, but I would like you to explain it a bit more, and not just saying emptiness is form and form is emptiness, because that's not helping me to understand and to understand it. So are there other ways that you can talk about emptiness?
Sure. Yeah, it's one of those things that any words we use are going to be partial. They're not always going to be complete. And let's see if I'll throw a couple things and then we can see if we can get some clarity or some understanding around it. So emptiness, again, it's empty of what, right? So usually internally, and it's really talking about this internal emptiness or fullness, or maybe not fullness is not the right word, but opposite of emptiness would be the normal chatter, the normal internal dialogue, the normal, narrative that's always going on, that sense of seeing something and we're always having some way of evaluating, doing something with it. Okay, I'm going to judge that. I'm going to want it. I don't want it. I like it. All that thing. I'm going to tell my friend about it. There's all that internal stuff that's going on. It's similar to like if we took a glass of water with some dirt in it and shook it up, all that dirt would be suspended. There'd be all this suspended particles would be very muddy, right? So emptiness or stillness or quiet is when that starts to fall away. So that internal experience, the subjective internal experience, is one of a vastness of, I guess, try not to use the word empty, of a spaciousness, a sense of something that's holding everything without any bias. There's no charge toward or away of anything, right? So what's fallen away is that charge, that internal dialogue, that internal argument. And it's a very deep internal sense that once you kind of taste it internally, what's fascinating is you can look externally and also perceive that. You can perceive it in, I like to do it with, start off with a tree or something. Okay, tree is there. There's a sense of aliveness in the tree. But if I look at it, if I'm looking at it not from that internal chatter, that internal friction, there's just an internal stillness and an external stillness that start to, there's some essence, something that's connected between them. That's why that word that we're not using right now doesn't match, because it's like you see that, everything is connected by the same essence. Another way to say it is like when you stop, it's like you let go of that, all that internal chatter, you connect back into what's kind of unifying everything. It's a little bit like a cup of water that's fallen back into the ocean. Does that help at all, Iris?
It does. And, sometimes I think about the fact, you know, the idea of impermanence on a cellular level, and whatever it was that the Buddha saw, you know, quantum physicists, you know, have now described, and maybe that's not the right term, but, you know, we're all made up, everything is made up of moving particles, you know, so that, you know, we, you know, I look solid, the table looks solid, my cat looks solid, the tree looks solid, but nothing solid, you know, which is very mind blowing to me to think about. Is that another way of trying to understand emptiness at all?
Well, I think different teachers might have different answers to that question. The way I'm going to answer it, including myself, I have different answers at different times. But right now, what comes to mind, or my sense of that, is we start to open to the insight of impermanence, as you said, that there's actually different maps of meditative practice that you start to really see that arising and passing. You notice all the arising, and at some stage you notice all the passing. And what that does in itself, you're seeing how something you thought was so solid is actually not solid, right? You're seeing that on a microscopic or almost a molecular level. And that's really helpful, because it's helping us loosen that identification around the solidity. Okay, I'm relating to myself or something else as being really solid. You start to see, oh, it's always arising and passing away, all right? That's an important process towards seeing emptiness. At some point, then that falls away, and there's just something that's holding all of it. It's like we're going to the waterfall. We're seeing all the water hitting us, and we go through the waterfall, and we see the stillness behind it. And the waterfall is still happening, but we're in a place of stillness. We've opened to that stillness, which is actually everything's arising and falling back into. Does that make sense? We're seeing the rising and passing versus seeing what it's falling back into. The backing into is that word we're not using right now.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Welcome. All right. Let me get Gary, and then we'll get you. Because Gary, I think, had his hand up right after Iris. Then we'll get you, Cheryl. Go ahead, Gary.
Thanks, Tim. Question is related to what I think you've been talking about of meeting people where they are without judgment. You talked about, you know, the bell and invited a person, and I feel like since I've met and studied with you, I've done pretty well on that. But a particular issue has come up with a person, I won't, of course, name anything, a family friend that has had issues, but I try to, every time I see him, I really pleasant fellow. And good conversations with him, but I recently just found out some horrible things that he's done. And I struggle the next time I see him. I feel like I cannot have that conversation without judgment. I'm bringing, it's just too much, right? That I just feel like, what the heck have you done, man? I mean, I don't know even how to begin a conversation without judgment because of, you know, things that I have heard, haven't seen, but they're pretty reliable. So again, to kind of rephrase this, easy to do for people I don't know, right? To come have a conversation, race, creed, color, whatever. That's pretty easy. But when something's charged with somebody I know that there are some issues, I'm really struggling with how to have that direct communication without bringing that baggage to the conversation.
All right. Thank you, Gary. That's a very nice, practical, meaty question. I think many people can relate to that. So think of it like when you hear the instructions, you know, see it without judgment. It's like you, it's you have to notice where the judgment actually is. Okay, so in this case, I mean, there's the judgment of this person's behavior, but you might say that's maybe more discernment, right? It's maybe more wisdom. Like, okay, he did something very unskillful, unharmful, whatever that those details are. We don't need to know those. I mean, you know them, but we can hold that. We can, okay, there's something that is not okay. That's discernment. The judgment part that's kind of making it stick perhaps for you is that you shouldn't be having that. But if you're more along the path, if you're like the Buddha, you'd be able to just be open-hearted toward this person without any kind of charge around it. Okay, that's the judgment that's getting stuck there. So can you learn to not judge that part, to really allow, okay, I really feel angry at this person. I feel like they've tricked me, or they're deceitful, or I don't trust them. I don't feel safe. I'm worried what kind of impact they're going to do. Let all that be not judged in yourself. Mm. Okay, so you're meeting yourself how you are. I think this is a common thing we get hung up on, as we project into this person or this situation. And often the situation is much more of a practical navigation. It's like, hey, that's not okay what you did, or I'm going to take steps to avoid that. It's like, you know, I just can't talk to you right now because of what I heard you did, or I want to check that out. There's so many different ways it can play out. But it's like that internal way that you're relating to it. Okay, can I fully, you know, just don't try to, like, I don't know if you were here the last time I talked about that idealism that gets in our way of integrating our practice. If I was further on the practice, I wouldn't be having this experience I'm having, right? That gets in our way because we kind of bound ourselves, we can't move because we put a straitjacket on called the Dharma and how we think the Dharma should be. It's like, how can I, I'm judging, but I can't, I'm supposed to judge. Like, all right. So take the straitjacket off, say, okay, I'm judging this person.
Right.
Feel that. And then from that place of fully acknowledging it, then the action arises from that. Does that make sense?
Yes. Challenging, but I'm looking forward to seeing this fellow. To give it a shot.
Yeah, and that, you know, with a situation like that, you know, a lot of it depends on what kind of relationship you have with them and what you want to have in the future. You know, because some people, the right action in such situations might be to directly say, can I talk to you about something?
Yeah.
And actually check out those allegations, you know, and see if that's true. You know, or maybe it's the wiser way is just to kind of drift apart and have more distance. I mean, there's a whole spectrum of how to be in the world. The important thing is for our own internal relationship, that has to be 100% honest, 100% open. And then from there, each situation we meet, we see what arises and what's the right way to arise. How do we interact? It's going to be, we're going to make lots of mistakes along the way.
I like that. I feel like next time when I do see him, it's a deep breath before we talk.
That's right.
And then just let things unfold. And what I'm also kind of hearing from you too, I'm not trying to change him, right? I think that's my, like, I want to show him what he did was so wrong and get him on the path to be better. But it's like, yeah, that's not my job. Mm-hmm. He didn't ask me to do that.
That's right. Yes, and maybe your job to protect yourself and those who are vulnerable. That might be part of your role.
Mm.
I mean, it's, you have to kind of, I don't know that, you know, the exact scenarios that we start to get, but it's, again, the important thing is to really learn how to meet your own experience, have as depth of clarity as you can, and from there that becomes a launching pad for action.
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, so let me go. Cheryl, do you still have? All right, we got Cheryl.
I better hear.
That's good.
I liked your talk. I understood it.
Good.
And it relates to something that I've been struggling with. Mm. And that's not trusting my perception. Often, lately, because I found my perception to be wrong so often. Mm. And so it's something, so as you're talking about, like, you know, seeing something, you know, for the first time, it's a hard thing to do. Mm-hmm. And, but I'm thinking about, like, my relationship with Kathy, my wife, and I, you know, and how I see her in a particular way, you know, how we see our partners in a particular way,
right.
You know, it's just what happens and how I move from that place. And I'm going to practice with this more. And I really like the quote about the, Nisargadatta.
Yes, Nisargadatta. I think I'm saying his name quite right, but yeah. When I look inside, I see I'm empty. Yes.
Yeah, inside and outside.
Everything.
What was it?
I see I'm then that's love.
Yeah, that's love.
In between the two, my life flows.
And I actually had a feeling of that the other day. It is funny. It's just a simple thing, but it was like I was looking at somebody. I was gonna, you know, it's just automatic that we have judgments about people that we see, you know.
Yeah.
And I thought, she's just like me. She's just like me. And I just had this body sensation of wow, yeah, she is. And I mean, it was, and if I could walk through life feeling like that all the time, I mean, it'd be really different.
Yeah. Well, as you bring more attention to it, more and more of that will arise that way.
Right.
Yeah. But
and so perceptions, you know, this like perceptions and And I think trying to see more clear, you know, I think when I'm not trusting my perceptions, it's coming from a place of me.
Mm.
And when I look at it, and what am I clinging to and all that. But anyway, yeah, good talk. I just really,
You're welcome. The sense of, you know, working with another person and trying to see through those perceptions. I remember early on with my wife, before we became married, I've, you know, said this a number of times, but we did this kind of reflective listening exercise. Actually, we learned that before we became married, but then we use it, you know, when we get into those arguments or those difficult spots. And that is really the heart of it, is just learning to listen fully. And not only listen and but actually articulate what you heard. So the person says, yes, you got it. Or no, you didn't quite get it. And if you're willing to set aside your own piece, so that's setting aside your perception. It's amazing. Like sometimes, you know how we get into those arguments or those fights around something. We each feel like, okay, we're right. That person's wrong. And we actually start to listen through that. I remember this one time we were doing it and just suddenly realized she had a very different way of viewing the world. That I had no concept that was even possible. But by doing that, I understood her much more deeply. And I realized the thing I was arguing about was really not, that wasn't what we were arguing about. It's more about different, you know, more tender pieces. That was just placeholders, but it was really insightful to just that gift to be able to see another person. That's clearing up that perception. And it does take, you know, if you have like a partner, like a committed partner, like Kathy, you know, having that dialogue, let me hear you and let me make sure I heard, let me actually articulate back. Let me see back what you said. And correct me if I'm wrong. And just keep doing that till she's talked out and then you switch. And it's really this beautiful listening and receiving. It's really coming. It's a way of really practicing this.
Yeah.
There's, have you seen that movie, A Beautiful Mind?
Yeah.
You know, because he was a schizophrenic or he would imagine people. Yeah, so he'd imagine people and they would tell him to do things. And as he worked through that and really understood it more and more, whenever he met a new person, he would say, do you see this person? He just wanted to double check that they were actually, you know, someone else could, you know, confirm that they were there. And it was just his own mind. And that's what I'm saying that is just, you know, talking to have friends that you can talk to, like, let me check out my perception and let me hear what you think it is. And they can help you. Help us all see things more clearly.
That's great. Yeah. That could help that issue.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So, Kathy, go ahead. Thank you for being the tech support.
Oh, my pleasure. Let me see if I'm kind of starting with where Iris was too about, it's a wonderful talk to Tim. Thanks for that. I'm I'm thinking about form is emptiness, and it seems to me from what we're saying, see if I have this right, that it's actually not empty, but it's just that there's more there than we knew, or it's different than we knew, or I worry about nothingness, like kind of nihilistic sort of, you know, sort of gloomy stuff, but actually it's just that it's all just way different than we were able to see because we brought all this stuff to it. Am I on the right track there?
Yes. Yeah, that's a helpful way to look at it. You know, let's take something like a tree. Okay, so I see the tree and let's say, you know, I see it and I say, okay, that's a tree. I start to relate to it. Where did you go, Kathy? Sorry, sometimes depending when people turn on and off their things. It's like my experiences, I'm like connecting and she's gone. I'm like, where did she go? I still hear her voice. So it's more for me just to keep that connection. So the idea of tree-ness, if we stay in that idea of it, it kind of keeps us a little separate from it. But if you let the idea of tree go and just actually connect with it, you know, like look closely at what the bark is like, you know, actually smell it, actually touch it, you know, look at it from different angles, get on the ground and look up at the canopy, you know, look at it with a little magnifying glass. We start to see more and more things around it than we wouldn't see if we just stayed the idea of tree. So that from the place of idea of tree, that's a form. That's kind of, it's full of just a small thing. But as we open, let go of that, then we see the richness of it, see the fullness of it. And that's really the subjective experience. When you open, when emptiness, to use that word we're trying to use, that we open to that, there's this fullness and richness of experience, whether it's our own internal experience, like the breath, the sensation, the experience of a loved one, experience of a tree, of a stranger.
Thanks, Tim. That's really beautiful.
Thank you, Kathy. All right, back. Anyone here online in person? Yes, come on up, Carlito. Did you have something too? All right, you can go next.
Thanks, Tim. Good segue. As you mentioned, you know, the tree example, it becomes much richer when you're kind of let your habit form of what tree is, drop away. And that helped to explain something for me. And also getting back to your sailboat example where you just kind of, I noticed that in myself, like, almost generating a false enthusiasm, you know, like, oh, okay, this, I'll do this, you know, and it's like, I can just feel that it's not real, but I digress. So using both of those examples, kind of the, as you know, not only will what I'm thinking is that not only will you, the wind kind of blow out of your sails, but, what that wind was doing also was forming a structure that was protective. So not only maybe are you losing enthusiasm or energy to move forward because, but you're also the structures that were protecting you from, say, early hood trauma or things like that fall away as well. And kind of like part and parcel, it's like, I'm not sure you can separate the two. And I've been noticing that and, you know, like realizing, oh, my God, I've been like that all my life. I'm just seeing it, you know, for the first time. I don't know. I just thought I'd bring it up. I'm not sure if I want practical advice. I mean, I think titration somehow might be appropriate. I'm not sure what that means, though. Does that mean taking a break from meditation for a while, or you know, and then, but then letting form reconstitute itself and be protective again. It's interesting little quandary that I have. So.
Yeah. So let me see if I can just say a few words around that. You said a few things. So first of all, the tree, you know, letting that tree just, you know, let go of the idea of tree and you see the richness of it. The same thing with ourselves, right? So, you know, it's meant to be a external practice thing that actually is meant to change ourselves also. And it does. When you do that to a tree, you're simultaneously doing it to yourself in relationship to that tree. And it's true, like with patterns of strategies or self-protection around trauma that we developed, those start to loosen up because they don't have the same, you know, there's a way we don't invest in them in the same way. We start to see that the strategy itself is not such a, you know, long-term solution. You can realize, okay, it worked at the time as a way to get through it, but it's not, you know, long-term. It's, you start to see that from a wisdom place.
Right.
But the thing is, we want to also be careful of abandoning those if they still have some service. And you might just reflect that, okay, here's this wind of protection from some childhood trauma. Just notice, okay, how is it protecting me? What's its structure? What's its form? And see if there's a way you can find another substitute for that. That's not, because often those childhood ones, you know, they got us through, but they don't work so well as an adult, right? We know that. You know, so you're kind of learning to upgrade that or kind of mature it up. So we don't let go of those winds until we, you know, even if they feel that you feel like, okay, that doesn't, wind doesn't have much, I can see its emptiness in it.
Right. It's not authentic.
It still has some service for me.
Right.
And that's the trick that, remember, there's form is everything. Form is empty. Then we think, okay, emptiness is everything. But then we come back to form and emptiness are really the same thing. Okay, so that's, you're kind of in that stage now that it's like, I got to let go of all form. But eventually you see that you can actually come back into those forms from a place of emptiness, from a place of, okay, I'm not invested in it. That's actually, you're talking about that. You're,
right.
You're not invested in the same way. It's not so critical to your survival or to your world, you know, the sense of you to have that form be there. You can use it actually as a tool that it's meant to be used as. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, the implementation is the trick. Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, sometimes it's easy to say things, but when we get into that, you know, always start, you know, I like to start in small ways, you know, just say, okay, kind of play with that a little bit. Yeah. All right. So do you want to go ahead, Deborah?
Yeah. I'm sort of trying to articulate this. I think we get stuck by that word empty because empty has, you know, it's more like being open.
Yeah.
Yeah. Open, yeah. I mean, there's obviously there's something in my hand, but there's air here.
Yes.
But it can be, I can take something in. If I close up, I can't take anything in. So we need to take off our armor.
Yeah.
What I'm struggling with is the inundation of messages, data. Like, you know, I delete the information that comes to me, refusing to look at it, refusing to answer. I don't open this envelope. I don't read this message. And then what am I missing? Am I closing myself off from what I ought to be open to receive? And how much of that is just putting on the armor and closing off to the world versus is this discernment or is it just rejection? Mm. You get stuck with that. There's just too much, you know, am I judging in a negative way or discerning what to open myself to in a positive way?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's really is a nice articulation of that. Because a lot of stuff we receive in our inboxes and our mailboxes, in the media, it's designed to kind of reestablish the form. Like, you should feel good about yourself. You should feel bad about yourself. You should feel good about yourself if you feel bad about yourself because you can buy my product. I mean, there's all this stuff going on. And, you know, that's going to all the political, all these things. It's really coming from that perspective. Okay, we've got to keep ourselves formed. So there's a discernment around that. But then there's that wisdom of, okay, what am I, maybe I am keeping myself too away, too protected from that. And it's really it's going to be like a moment by moment thing. That what I would play with is, you know, get something and just notice your initial reaction and just hang out there in that initial impulse. Don't follow it quite yet. Let's say it's literally a piece of mail in your mailbox. You'll hold the envelope. Okay, I'm going to throw that away. Just relax with it for a moment. Just feel the impulse and say, okay, is that coming from a place of discernment or wisdom? And just hold that question. Is it coming from compassion or from aversion? Right? And so it's like literally each time you have to kind of explore that till you start to know your own tendencies really well. And then it's easier to kind of have that discernment. As long as you keep that openness, you know, that's okay. Sometimes you're going to say no. And is it better to say no more often or more yes more often? I'm not sure. You know, and maybe finding avenues of hearing about what's going on in the world that, you know, feel right to you. That feel okay. I can listen to that. It's not going to be too much. And be willing to kind of pause. I always like to, when I hear something that's really touches me, like hearing some tragedy, you know, I like to turn off the radio, stop reading for a moment, and let myself really feel that. Let that sink in. Let me digest that. And that way I'm really connected to the pain of the world without becoming overwhelmed by it. Does that help at all?
Sinking in, you have to be open for
that's right.
Let it sink in. If you put a Teflon layer on yourself, nothing sinks in.
That's right. Yeah. So notice. Yeah. So when you feel, notice that impulse of loading up the Teflon, the armor. Okay, and just play with. Okay, let me open that armor a little bit. Let me just practice feeling this one little piece here. Right. And maybe it's too much. Maybe it's, you realize, okay, the armor isn't serving you as much. Maybe it is serving you. It's like something like that. That's a great custom-made practice for you. And the simple ingredients are pause, see what's present, see what impulse you want to do, practice going opposite of that, and see what happens. Yeah. Thank you, Deborah. All right. Anyone back online? Yeah, come up, Beth.
I want to thank Iris for saying what you said, because I've been feeling like, what the heck? You know, this emptiness stuff is really hard to wrap my mind around. When you describe it, I feel it. I know what you're, but then I think, what do I do with this? And so I've appreciated what people were saying, operationalizing.
Yeah.
The experience of emptiness is something that I'm able to feel, but then I have to get up. I have to drive my car and I have to do something. And I think when I get stuck, I think about teachers, and tonight I've been like flashes of things that y'all have said. I wanted to share two things with, one, Pema Chodron talked about seeing A Beautiful Mind. Hmm. And when she saw that movie, she said she, it pushed her into emptiness for days. Hmm. So that was kind of an anchor for me. Hmm. And when you were talking, Deb, about, like exposing self to input. And I think about when I want to shut down and I want to stop reading and it's so horrible and the world is awful. I think about the Dalai Lama, how he gets up at like 2 a.m. and starts doing his stuff, and he reads the paper every day and he watches BBC News every day. And, you know, if anybody had a reason not to do that, it'd be him, because he's really busy. So sometimes I think I don't want to read my New York Times anymore. And I think, okay, the Dalai Lama read it, so I guess I'm going to read it. Yeah. So thank you.
Thank you, Beth. Yeah, that's, you know, such, you know, people we really respect and admire and have a lot of, you know, yeah, just yeah, admiration for. They can inspire us in those ways, hearing how they meet those challenges. Okay, I can, that's a lovely way. If the Dalai Lama can do it, I can do it. Yeah. And I appreciate Iris, you know, bringing up what is emptiness? What is that? Because it is, we throw out these words and we, you know, it's important to really unpack them and explore them and try to explain them without using that word at all. Because they have, you know, we can kind of just, we have our own way in Dharma practitioner circles of having our own way of holding things, our own way we, all the things I've been talking about, we have our perceptions, and that keeps us locked. So it's really helpful to explore that. Okay, Iris, go ahead.
Well, I wish I could make a good joke here because, I mean, what the Dalai Lama can do is not necessarily something that I think I can do. So, you know, he's sort of, maybe if he's not enlightened, he's pretty darn close. So, anyway, Beth, give yourself a break.
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword. Certainly we can, like I talked about last time, they're so far away. I there's no way I can do that. That's not so helpful. But if it brings that sense of inspiration, like it was working for Beth, then that's the way. It's really finding where's that place we can engage in our practice. And we have to try lots of different ways at different times. How do we hook that up? Because it's hard. We have a lot of stuff in our own momentum of our minds, of our own conditioning. We have society, we have the world. It's just, it can be a lot to go against. That's why the Buddha said the Dharma is like swimming upstream, right? So anything you can do, grab onto a boat, grab onto another fish, whatever it might be. All right. Any last questions? We had a short talk and it's been many questions, which I appreciate. Yes, come. Yeah, please.
Hi, I'm Christina. I have been sitting and mostly listening. It's my first time coming up to the mic. And in that vein, I guess, in this space, I'm wondering how all of that is being talked about with these ox herding pictures fits in with the difference between a spirituality practice and a religious practice. Mm. And there's the Dalai Lama, there's certain figures that are closer to enlightenment. Yeah. And I would venture to say that folks here are interested in enlightenment. And I think I am one of those. Something that I think growing up not having a religious background, I don't have like a Christian faith where there's someone that says, God has brought us to this earth and this is how, why we're here. And I'm wondering just if I could get some information about, in a Buddhist lens, what is like the significance of mankind, or is that not a question that comes to the surface for Buddhist practitioners?
So let me see if I understand. So kind of the core of it is there something like, you know, what God gave man to do this, whatever it is. I wasn't raised Christian either, but was there something that's the purpose of from a Buddhist perspective or more of a religious perspective?
Sure. And like suffering is inevitable, or has been brought to mankind as an inevitable component.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if there's a rhyme or reason in Buddhist literature or scholars that would say that there is.
Yeah. Again, depending who you talk to, there'd probably be different answers. One way to answer it is from a cosmology standpoint. So, you know, part of, you know, SIMS is mostly a Dharma or contemplative organization. So we're really, you know, how do we liberate our hearts and minds? And yet there's also this whole Buddhist perspective on different lifetimes, different reincarnations, and different realms of existence, right? So that's kind of the cosmology. So from that perspective, there's realms which are, you know, kind of more hell realms. There's realms which are really hard. There's realms which are really heavenly. And the human realm is considered really nice because there's enough suffering that it makes us want to practice. It's not enough pleasure. It's enough pleasure that we're not overwhelmed by it. It's not too much pleasure because otherwise we won't want to practice. So in some ways, it's like a really perfect sweet spot. Because if we're in the hell realm or like an animal realm, we won't have enough energy. It would be like, I'm just trying to survive here. If I'm up like, you know, everything I want is just granted me instantly, I'm not going to want to practice. But we have right the right amount of rub. So that's, and that, and really that's the whole purpose of practice. And that's of dukkha, is to get over that constant rebirthing, you know, going into the next lifetime, because it's a, you know, in our society, it's kind of like, well, yeah, I want to be born again. I want to reboot the game. That's a little bit of our attitude. But if you look at how much suffering there's this freedom from that. So that's kind of in a nutshell, that whole getting off the world of samsara and the place of the human birth.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for coming up. All right. So thank you all for your great questions and engagement. Yeah, always feel free to say, tell me what that word means, or tell me in a different way. It's because together we all start to explore it in a more full way. So thank you all for your questions, both online and in person. So next week, Carrie Peterson will be here because I'll be teaching at Cloud Mountain. And I think she'll be doing the oxfording pictures, or she might talk about something else. We'll see what she does. Then I'll be back in December, the middle 2 weeks, and then we're going to be taking the 26th and the 2nd off. Have a little Buddhist Christian holiday, I guess. I don't know what we'll call that. We'll just say a break. How about that? All right. Have a lovely evening, and we'll see you in a couple weeks, and enjoy Carrie next week.